my first question for you is I'd like you to introduce yourself. And in that, we'll get to hear how you pronounce your last name. And I want you to also tell us tell me about the ways you've heard your last name mispronounced.
Okay, so my name is Adam Ollier. It's pronounced Ollier. Sounds like Hollier. I've heard everything from Hollier to Hollister to Holyfield. Actually, a pretty funny story. I was out at an event, and this lady walked up to me, and I'm not wearing, you know, any identifying T-shirts or anything like that. And she walks up, and she's like, "Hey, Mr. Holyfield, I'm so excited about you. I'm voting for you. I appreciate you came by the house. It's so nice to hear you." I was like, Adam, remember Adam. Adam is good. So, Ollier.
Ollier. Got it. Okay, so tell me about where you grew up and what that was like.
So I've lived just about my entire life in the same neighborhood. I grew up just south of Boston Edison over in the North End. I live in the North End right now. So I went to elementary school over at Flicks, which is now where the Humane Society is over on Kniffin 75. My mom's lived in the neighborhood. You know, she grew up in the neighborhood. I went to Detroit Public Schools, Flicks Halley Renaissance, got a bachelor's from Cornell, master's from the University of Michigan. I live two blocks from my parents in the neighborhood I was raised in. My brother lives a block away from me. Both of my sisters live on my parents' block. So my whole family kind of lives in this one block radius over in the North End.
And what's that like?
It's amazing. So I have a 9-month-old daughter, and we are a very close family, and it's really nice to be able to drop off my daughter when, you know, I need to go to a thing or those types of things. So my mom has been really, really incredibly helpful in taking care of our little rascal. My dad, wife, and I go to the football games, and so my mom and I joke that we trade Lily for my dad back and forth. So she's like, "All right, I'll trade you your dad for Lillian." And I'm like, "Hey, Mom, I'll trade you Lillian for dad on football days." So,
oh, you're passing them around.
Yeah, she's the best.
Aw. Okay, and you mentioned Cornell, which of course is an Ivy League school in Ithaca. Talk about your time there and what that was like.
So Cornell was just the most amazing, incredible experience ever. So when I was figuring out schools, I knew I wanted to play football. I played football there. I ran track. I was a decathlete. I was really involved in the American Indian program, in the Black Students Union. It was a real opportunity to just kind of do very different things. But I chose Cornell because they have a school for industrial and labor relations. And so the only reason my dad is alive today is because of the impact the firefighters union had on life safety and work rules. And so when I got to thinking about school and thinking about college, labor was really important to me. And it was a pretty impactful idea, and to be able to study labor history and to really understand how it worked made a huge impact. And it was a big deciding reason and why I went to Cornell.
Great. And then you mentioned you went on to get your master's in urban planning at the University of Michigan. What did you learn from studying urban planning that you feel that you could apply to being a state senator?
So a lot of the discussion that we see nowadays leans on tax incentives. It leans on how we invest public resources. But most of it deals with our lack of planning, right? So you look at the discussions in Flint or in DPS, where they talked about our failing infrastructure, and we aren't planning for resilient communities. We aren't planning for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years and how our communities are going to be used, how they're going to continue to work. And those are a lot of things that we look at in the planning sphere. At U of M, I was able to help do a vacant property strategy and plan for the Osborne neighborhood, which is a part of the district that I plan to be representing later this year. So it really prepared me to think not about small solutions, but to think about how all the different issues knit together and think about creative ways that are guided by best practices and ways that people have been successful, right? So a number of people think that what happened in Detroit was based on mismanagement or any of those types. It was changes in the way we live and the way people have thought we were going to live. So the idea that suburbanization created certain issues is a reality. And understanding that because that phenomenon started here with highways, with, right after World War II and victory homes and things like that, those issues started in Detroit and in the region. And so you see them permeating all across the country. So the things that are happening that were happening in Detroit 5, 6 years ago, you see happening in other you know, communities all across the country, whether that was the subprime lending, whether it was the changing in manufacturing or any number of those things, the same way you see the opportunity for urban revitalization and how that looks versus some other communities starting in Detroit.
So you worked for more than 3 years as the chief of staff for Senator Burt Johnson. When he served in this very seat you're running for, what did you do as chief of staff, and what, if anything, did you learn in that role that could make you be a better state senator?
I learned a ton. I mean, it was an incredible experience as your first job out of grad school to be the chief of staff for, in the state house and then moving into the state senate, where I got a chance to be in the majority and in the minority, where I got a chance to work on fairly large policy initiatives, right? So the first project I got in the office was the Aerotropolis, and it was some legislation that had failed twice over the last 2 years, or the last two sessions, I should say, and it was right up my alley, right? So you're talking about economic development tools to build a robust program around city airport or around metro airport that would, you know, involve mega tax credits and historic tax credits and all these kind of combination of things, and really incentivizing the growth and development of this space that two communities and constituencies really wanted or didn't want, right? So it was initially not controversial, but it was contentious between then county executive Bob Ficano and Mayor Bing's administration, because they were talking about the different impact that having these special tools out at Metro Airport versus in the city or some of these other places would have, and really trying to iron those things out. So I got a firsthand view at, you know, the differences in constituencies, because you look at it and you're like, hey, this is good for the region. And, you know, the city was like, yeah, maybe good for the region, but it's more good for the Western Wayne side of the region than it is for Detroit. And so in that compromise, we, you know, allowed Detroit to take advantage of those similar tools and do the type of economic development that is necessary. And there I learned a lot about compromise. I learned a lot about how important it was to work with people who you agree with, who you disagree with. So my last big project in the Senate was the Regional Transit Authority. And in that, you know, we had to work with Republicans. So the first thing, we were in the majority in the House, so we had a greater degree of flexibility and control. Getting RTA done, we were in the minority. And so I had to convince Senator Tom Casperson, who's a conservative Republican from Escanaba, to come on board as one of the lead sponsors for the RTA bills. And why him? It's because he was the chair of the Senate Transportation Committee, because he was open-minded enough to come spend the day riding buses with us through Detroit. And when you, if you've ever ridden the buses in Detroit, or if you had ridden them in those days, and this is 2011, they weren't running that on time, right? So we started in Highland Park, rode down the Woodward bus, took us more than an hour to go from Highland Park down to Detroit. So we're talking about a 6-mile drive, took us more than an hour on the bus, not waiting on the bus, on the bus. You talk about going up Gratiot at the end of the day and then having that issue of having to get off the DDOT bus at 8 Mile, get on the Smart Bus, and to go just up Gratiot to 10 Mile took us 5 hours. And then to come back across 10 Mile took us another 2 or 3. So you talk about really understanding the dysfunction. And what it taught me was that, for the most part, people get into this business for the right reasons. We just have to make sure that we understand each other's perspectives and viewpoints so that we can inform policy that represents and takes care of our people.
So Senator Burt Johnson was, of course, convicted of stealing more than $23,000 from taxpayers by adding a non-working employee to his payroll. How does that make you feel?
Not good. So Burt Johnson was a groomsman at my wedding. He's a friend. I coached his kids in Little League. You know, he was involved in my race. You know, that was not an ideal scenario for anything or anyone. I think the important part to look at that is, and I felt this very strongly about our criminal justice system, I think that our system should be doing everything it can to decrease the likelihood that people go back, but also that it should do for people and not be as punitive as it has been, right? So you look at drug crimes, you look at any of these other things, and most of the punishment that we levy on individuals is to punish them. It doesn't rehabilitate. It doesn't fix. It does not help the people that have been aggrieved by any of those issues.
So how are you convincing voters that they should trust you? Why should voters trust you?
Well, the easy part is the federal government does. So I maintain a secret security clearance. I'm an officer in the military. And the reason that that is applicable because it shows that when you look at the background check that I've received, it's very thorough, right? So there's nothing that people will need to be surprised with that. But I think the biggest part is my work ethic, right? So you look at my experience working both in the Senate, working in the mayor's office, working in the private sector at Hans Woodlands, in the nonprofit sector at the Fitness Foundation. My word has always been my word, and my work speaks for itself. So you look at a record of accomplishment, somebody who has lived in this community and lived in this neighborhood my entire life, where I chose to invest, where I chose to live and do those types of things. It helps that, you know, my daughter loves me and smiles and is all those happy things. But I think it's all about the work, right? So you know people and you trust them because they have shown themselves to be trustworthy. And so every day I try and continue to do that, right? By being open, by being honest, by being straightforward, and simply by saying, hey, this is who I am. When I make mistakes, I try and own up to them and continue to listen and move forward.
So you mentioned the military. We'll get to that briefly in a little bit. But you also mentioned Hans Farms. Well, Hans Woodlands, which is, I don't completely understand the difference between Hans Farms and Hans Woodlands.
It's kind of the same thing. So okay. Hans Farms is the broader thing. Hans Woodlands is a subsidiary. But it, in some ways, very much so the same thing.
Okay. You were the vice president of Hans Farms.
Yes.
So talk about that.
So it was this kind of crazy idea that was wildly controversial 4 years ago. What year is it? 2018? Yeah. So in 2014, this kind of wildly controversial thing where this very wealthy white banker bought, you know, basically all the public land in a 1 square mile, like 1,500 lots from the city of Detroit. And everyone was like, oh, no, it's going to be, you know, this or that. But the reality was John lived in the neighborhood, right? He lived just immediately next to the community that he was doing. And for every Detroiter or everyone in the county who knows what it's like to live next to a vacant lot that the city or the county or whoever isn't maintaining, it's frustrating, right? And when you see somebody clean up 3 lots next to them who doesn't have a lot of who don't have a lot of resources, who don't have just incredible capacity, no one wonders, well, why did they do that? But John, who had incredible capacity, was tired of every day looking out and saying, hey, maybe one day this is going to get better. Maybe someone will fix this. And so he did. And I think what's really critical in these discussions is this is not public land, or this wasn't public land, right? So these are properties that were foreclosed on that fell to the city to maintain. Not parkland, not, you know, land that was going to be used by anyone else, but land that really made it dangerous. And so I sum up and the work that we did, I thought was going to be impactful for a variety of reasons. What I came to find out was that it was for one reason and one reason alone, that it was worthwhile. So we started doing a lot of work with the schools in the district, particularly with Southeastern. And so I was there talking to a class of seniors, and we were saying, hey, you know, what is the impact that you think this project has had? And at this point, we had cleared 1,500 lots of blight, garbage, and debris, 2 or 3 tons of tires, and just all kinds of stuff, right? And as adults, we get caught up in the numbers of, hey, how much garbage did you move? How many houses did you demolish? How much did you, you know, yada, 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 yada. And this young lady who was going to Fair States, I said, hey, well, what's the impact to you? And she says, I go to school on time. I was kind of dumbstruck. I was like, well, what do you mean you go to school on time? And she said, before that, I was afraid of 2-legged and 4-legged dogs. And in my mind, I had this visual of, well, how dangerous is a 2-legged dog? And it's funny because every woman I know is like, she was afraid if she was going to get pulled into one of those vacant homes or in that tall grass and raped. That, and every guy, it takes them a couple seconds to reconcile that. But every woman who hears that immediately knows what we're talking about. And not only is that not okay, not only is it incredibly frustrating, but that's the reality of what blight does in neighborhoods that we don't think about. that we aren't talking about. So here's someone who is going to make it and in a school where not very many were. And she missed class every day until the sun came up in Michigan because it wasn't safe for her to go to school. And she was a senior in high school. Think about what that's like for the two elementary schools in this district. You know, kids aren't walking to school. Kids aren't able to do those types of things. They aren't able to be kids. And that's why the project was so appealing to me, because it made an impact in people's lives in a way that was both meaningful but sustainable.
And there's no question that the land has been cleaned up. It now has trees planted on it, which can be harvested for timber. But some people do say it is a form of land speculation. It is a way of holding a large swath of land that could be sold. So just to kind of give another side to all the benefits of the project that you already mentioned. And I do have to say, in addition to it being your former employer, that executives and planners who work for Hance Group, which is a related company, they have contributed at least $18,000 to your campaign collectively, which is the highest amount of money that your campaign has received other than from yourself. So I just needed to point that out. But if you want to comment on how that affects your feelings at all, feel free.
No, I know those folks. So those are people who I worked with, right? So it's not like these are secret folks in a room. You know, these are people who I met, who I worked with when I planned Tree Planting Day, where we planted 45,000 trees. These are people who believed in me, who believed in the vision that I have for the district, and I appreciate that. And when you look at the district, and as people make the claim about it being land speculation or any of those types of things, that's exactly what the city was doing. That's what the county does. That's what any one of those groups do. The difference is this land is being maintained, right? And if you go talk to any neighbor in the community, and I would absolutely encourage you to do so, if you haven't been over there, to go look at it and look at the difference between that neighborhood and any other one. So you look at Hamtramck or Highland Park. Well, not Hamtramck. You look at Highland Park or the northeast side of the city, and you say, all right, well, what does it look like when the city or the county own these vacant properties? They don't have the capacity to maintain them versus what it looks like today.
So let's move on and talk about your military service. I saw on your LinkedIn that you currently serve in the 414th Civil Affairs BN as the S4 officer in charge, OIC USAR, for us civilians. What does that mean?
So I just changed units recently.
Okay.
So now I'm in the 412th Civil Affairs Battalion. So CA is Civil Affairs and BN is Battalion. In the 414th, I was the S4, which is the supply officer. So I was in charge of the supply section.
What does that mean?
So people would say beans and bullets, but also maintenance, all the vehicles, all the food, all the equipment that we have, radio. So you're talking multi-million dollars worth of property, maintaining that, ensuring that we're deployable. So I'm also the unit movement officer. So if my unit were ever to deploy, I'm responsible for getting all of our stuff there, packing it up, making sure that it gets there, making sure that all the people are able to travel. So really all of the logistics of moving my unit and my unit being able to conduct its missions. And so at the 412th, so my old unit was in Southfield. My new unit is in Columbus, Ohio. Yeah, it's a little bit of a hike, but it's been great. It's an airborne unit. I'm excited about the opportunity. We're in a ready force battalion. So we're right at the edge of what's coming on. So it's really an incredible opportunity. Civil affairs officers are the Army's version of diplomats. We provide specialized services to communities. So we have veterinarians, we have functional specialists, whether that be education, law enforcement, government. So there are tons of kind of these different capacity buildings that we provide local community. But when you hear the military talking about hearts and minds, that's my unit's responsibility of going and connecting, having key leader engagements with local communities and really developing the relationships that allow us to stabilize and to be able to move through and use villages and interact with the local populace in a safe and conducive manner.
So if you are elected state senator, will you be able to maintain your work in the military service?
I absolutely will. And I think that that's an incredibly – so I appreciate that you ask. And the reason I appreciate that is because it gives me an opportunity to talk about what it means to be a modern reservist or member of the National Guard, right? So we deploy at very high volumes, particularly compared to the Guard or the Reserve's life at any other moment in history. So probably since the Revolutionary War or the Civil War, no time since has there been as high of a mobilization for Guard and Reservists. And the reason that is because we no longer have a draft. So the entire military are volunteers. And what that means is your colleague, your friend, your neighbor who also serves in the Guard or Reserve has to reconcile that with their civilian employer. And it is one thing that people say they love soldiers and they love the troops and, you know, they kind of support us in that broader stroke. But it's a whole different thing when you have an employee who has been deployed three times in the last 5 or 10 years, and or 5 or 6 years, I should say, and what that means for losing them, for them coming in and out to serve, what it means for their families and all of those types of things. So I think as a state senator, not only do I have the opportunity and the obligation to serve, but I have the opportunity to make it much more clear to employers what they're getting themselves into, but also what it means to actually support soldiers and their families as they deploy, as they deal with these types of things, and to really modernize the legislation to provide soldiers and their families with the protections that they need. Because, yeah, you're like, well, hey, you may be gone. What if you're gone while things are happening? Then I'll be gone just like the person who is, just like your doctor, just like your mechanic, just like any of those other folks who have to be gone. And if the systems don't work to protect me, if they don't allow me to leave, then they aren't working for your mechanic. They aren't working for your grocer. They aren't working for the folks who are really committing everything to go out and serve us. And they've got to work.
In just a moment, we'll move on to the issues. But first, I want to give you a chance to talk about your current job.
So I am the Director of Government and Community Relations at the Michigan Fitness Foundation. And the Michigan Fitness Foundation is associated with the Governor's Council on Physical Fitness and Sports. So it's the nonprofit arm of that, which came from the President's Council on Physical Fitness and Sports. Right. So the governors decided that that was a good idea. So about 30 years ago, they created the President's Council. And then a little over 20 years ago, they created the Michigan Fitness Foundation to actualize kind of those good policies. So we do SNAP Ed for the state. We do Safe Routes to Schools. In my capacity, I'm also the outgoing chair of the Iron Bell Trail Fund, which would be a biking, walking, hiking trail from Belle Isle to Ironwood up in the UP. It'll be the longest continuous trail in a single state, talking about multiple thousands of miles of biking and hiking and walking trail, which will just be amazing. And so what I do is I advocate for healthy living, healthy lifestyles, increased funding, helping with our partners as they do nutrition-based learning, physical education things. And so it's been an incredible opportunity. I've been there almost 2 years now.
Great. So why do you want to be state senator for Michigan?
That's a great question. So I want to be a state senator because of my dad. When I was about 10 years old, my dad and I went to the Million Man March. And when we went, we had this great experience, but kind of amusing now that was never relevant before. When the president was talking about his crowd sizes, he was like, oh, hey, they're the largest crowds ever. When I was at the Million Man March, I was like, wow, I've never seen people like this in my entire life. And there was all this discussion about how many people were actually there on the Capitol lawn. And I was like, hey, Dad, how do they calculate this thing? Oh, well, they take aerial photos. So I convinced my dad to go up to the Washington Monument and take a photo looking down. He takes his photo, and you can see people bulging at the seams from everywhere. Fast forward, the photo became kind of popular. And so the Firefighters Association, the Black Firefighters Association, who we went with, presented a copy of this photo to Mayor Archer. Mayor Archer looked at it, and he was like, hey, you know, it's rare that you see someone who sees a problem and immediately acts to it. And I was like, thanks. He was like, you should think about doing that and being in this type of business. And not too long after that, my dad set me down, and he said, hey, Adam, you could never be a firefighter. And I was like, Dad, what are you talking about? Because, you know, as a little kid, firefighter is just about the coolest thing you can bring to career day unless your dad is the president or an astronaut, right? Like, it's hard to beat firefighter. And Dad is like, this is not the business for you. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, you don't have that little bit of fear that tells you not to go in. My dad would always say that the hardest decision he ever had to make was that there were people he couldn't save. And he would always say that I didn't have that in me, that I was always going to try, that I was always going to go in, that I was always going to believe that I could do it. And that was a great trait in everything but firefighting. And so he said that there were three E's of fire prevention, right? There's education, engineering, and enforcement. And he challenged me to do something in that regard, in that space. And when you think about what Mayor Archer had said to me and what my dad was saying to me, I started thinking, well, who's looking out for people like my dad, right? Who's making sure that my dad has the right equipment, that he's got the right support, that he's got those types of things? And the year before, my dad had been in a bad accident, right? So he fell through a floor, and the fourth man on the truck is the person who pulled him out, right? So the Detroit Firefighters Union always fought for this four-man ride. And the city would say, oh, you don't need that. We're going to send two or three trucks. Like, you'll have enough people. But that fourth person pulled my dad out of a fire. That fourth person saved my dad's life. And that was a work rule, right? So we talked about why I went to Cornell in with the idea that it was about these kind of things. And so I decided at that moment I was going to spend the rest of my life taking care of the people who take care of us. And as I decided that was what I was going to do, I kept finding myself in service. I kept finding myself doing that. I spent a summer in Biloxi, Mississippi, doing relief work after Hurricane Katrina, and I saw communities that looked like the one I was raised in that were changing overnight because people said, hey, this didn't happen overnight. We can't wait. But you look in Detroit and people said, hey, this didn't happen overnight. It's not going to get fixed overnight. And Biloxi, they're like, this took 12 hours to happen. We are going to get fixed. It's been 3 months. This is unacceptable. It's been 6 months. It's been a year. And so I said, man, we could do that. You know, I worked in the Senate. I worked in the mayor's office, and I saw the ability to get things done and said, hey, if people had the right skills, if they were committed to actually doing the work, we could make a real impact. I looked out and said, hey, I can do this. I want to do this. I want to go fix it. I want to go be there for people who need it. You know, you talk about that young lady who wasn't going to school on time because it wasn't safe. That's unacceptable. That's why I'm running. Because I want kids to be able to walk to school. I want firefighters to have what they need. I want our community to be better and safer and the type of place that people dream for.
So can you describe Senate District 2?
All right. Are you ready for a gerrymandering pen? So Senate District 2 is one of the most diverse districts in the state. It has some of the wealthiest folks in Grosse Pointe, to some of our newest residents in Hamtramck in southwest Detroit. It's got, you know, you look at Hamtramck, which is the most densely populated city in the state. It's a state where more languages are spoken in the public school system than any other school in the state. It's got a thriving Yemenis and Bengali population. It's the only city in the country with a majority Muslim city council. You look at Highland Park, which is a bastion of the past, right? So it's where the original Model T plant was. It's a place that up until the 70s and 80s was routinely considered one of the best communities in the country to live and raise a family. And now you see so much change, right? So you've got a little bit of Midtown. You've got a little bit of Wayne State, Southwest, portion of Boston Edison. You have a community that is representative of the state that stretches from the base of Grosse Pointe Park up to include all five Grosse Pointes, Harper Woods, the northeast side of Detroit, coming along 8 Mile, 8 Mile down to Van Dyke, 7 Mile across to DeQuinder, skirting a 6-block cutout in Conant Gardens that shows how gerrymandering is a thing. Going all the way to 6 Mile in Linwood, going basically over to Central High School, splitting Boston Edison in half, north of Claremont. And they coming along and traveling between the Lodge and John R., going down in the southwest along McGraw, going over to Spring Rails, coming back above 75, come back up John R., cutting a large portion, large swath of the north end out between John R. and I-75, picking up Hamtramck, mostly going north of 94 with a couple spots taken out, including East English Village. So it's a winding district that touches almost all the city council districts, all but two. Touches, you know, five state rep districts, the first, the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, and maybe the seventh. So you're talking about a district that does a lot.
Covers a lot. So what are your issues then?
So number one for me is kids walking to school, right? And so kids walking to school means safe neighborhoods. It means good schools within walking distance, and it means small business growth and development. Immediately, you know, and everything around that, around my agenda is about livability and making it less onerous to be impoverished, right? So auto insurance, making it so that you can actually afford to drive a car, right? We spend all this time talking about, you know, the need for regional transit and infrastructure investments and those types of things. But auto insurance is the thing that prevents people from getting to work. We've got a lower auto insurance rate. Moves us into infrastructure investments. I love regional transit. I was really involved in getting the legislation done. We got to get something going. And then right after that, we really got to really, really, really reinvest in our infrastructure and not just roads, right? So in Flint, there was this big discussion about lead. And for years, people forgot that, oh, shoot, that same problem is going to happen in Detroit because they all have lead service. That same problem is going to be happening in Hamtramck and Highland Park, in Saginaw and Grand Rapids and all these communities across our state that were built at the time where lead was the common building material. We got to get those lead pipes out. And when we fix our roads, we should be replacing the pipes. When we replace the pipes, we should be replacing the electrical conduit. We should be, you know, putting in high-speed internet. We should be doing all of the infrastructure that made Michigan grow, right? So the Davison Freeway, which is the first depressed highway in the country.
And by depressed, you mean below?
Below ground, below grade, yes. Is in the 2nd Senate District. Almost its entirety is in the 2nd Senate District. And that's why the Model T factory was there. The first paved concrete road is Woodward. That's why the Model T plant was there. So the innovation, the groundbreaking things that happened in our community a generation or two ago happened here, not by chance, but because we built the things necessary to support those industries. And right now, we have got to reinvest in our infrastructures to do the same thing. And that infrastructure has got to be more than just the built environment. It is laying the foundation for strong schools in both the skilled trades, in the computer program, and all those things that are necessary for us to be competitive as a community.
So then we get to the how.
Oh, yeah. Awesome. So one way is marijuana, I'm a firm believer, is going to become legal. And I think that the state of Colorado has done a really good job of using those increased dollars to invest in the long-term potential of their residents, right? So they did exactly what we just talked about. They said, all right, we're going to spend these marijuana dollars, these hundreds of millions of new tax dollars on fixing their roads, on fixing their schools, on building their schools, doing those types of things. That's what we should be doing with those types of things. But we're going to have to add, we're going to have to do revenue enhancements. We're going to have to right size what our things look like. So not only are we going to have to add to the pot, but we're going to have to take some out, right? So you look at the pension tax that the governor brought in very early in the change and how seniors or, you know, personal income is a share of the state budget. It's completely out of whack. We've got to do more. Everyone always says you have to do more with less, but we've got to find a way to get more. To do more. Some of it is with marijuana. Some of it is going to be in changing how we fund roads. So we'll have to do differences in gas tax. We're going to have to do new revenue, and it's going to have to be creative. And one thing that you should expect from me as a state senator is to know that I do not know everything, and that I will be leaning on the expertise of people who spend their entire lives learning one thing, right? Learning how to really know how to fund mass transit, learning how to really fund infrastructure improvements, because people are doing it. Let's do the same thing.
So you mentioned auto insurance and that you'd like the rates to go down. How do you think that can happen? What would you like to see happen to then decrease rates?
I think there are lots of things I would love to see happen. I'd like to stick to things that I believe are doable, right? So one of the big reasons that auto insurance is so expensive in Detroit is because people are not affluent. They're not super wealthy. Right. And there is absolutely an economic issue in that, because insurance, whether people want to believe it or not, is a financial product. It doesn't have any, it has very little to do with your driving record. It's all about risk. And people who have less money are more likely to be a higher risk from a financial standpoint. So what we've got to do is we've got to provide people not only with options, but we've got to start to address those root causes of those things. So I talked about insurance as a issue for impoverished individuals and for poverty and those types of things. And that's what I still want to do. And so I want to make reference to, first, the big issue is people can't afford it because they can't afford to do those types of things. The way we solve it is by making by giving people the opportunity for choice. Right. So on your home insurance, you can choose to insure at replacement cost. You can insure a specific amount. You can get just fire. You can get, you know, all kinds of different things. I believe you should have the same thing for auto insurance. The big problem with auto insurance is so much is our health insurance is so deficient that to get adequate care for a number of individuals, they have to rely on their auto insurance and the, you know, the issues that are resulting from that. So I think part of it is we've got to deal with health insurance outside of auto insurance. The other thing is we've got to allow people to control how much they want. So if you want unlimited benefits, you can pay for unlimited benefits. If you want 500,000 or 200 or 300 or whatever the case may be, I believe you should have the option to do that. The hospital association or the hospitals are going to have to take some degree of cuts on the amount that they charge for some of those things. Insurance companies, auto insurance companies should be able to negotiate a price. Right. So there is what they call the let's just call it sticker price. Right. So you go to a car lot and there's sticker price, the MSRP, and auto insurance pays sticker price. Blue Cross Blue Shield doesn't pay sticker price, or HAP or any of those people don't pay sticker price. We've got to find a way to balance that for the auto industry. The next part, though, is we've got to find a way to support that with the hospitals, because HAP and Medicare, Medicaid aren't paying sticker price. Somebody's got to pay sticker price so that hospitals can continue to exist, right? And particularly in a community like Detroit, where you have DMC, where you have Henry Ford, who are seeing people who may be in that indigent space, who don't have appropriate health care to cover their injuries. And these hospitals have to do it. They have to provide them with care. And so they can't be a losing profit. You know, it can't be a losing proposal for them to stay in business. So we've got a lot of work to do when you talk about choice, when we talk about affordability, and a lot of it stems from needing real reform in the healthcare industry.
So you mentioned your efforts related to the Regional Transit Authority, the bill that made that possible. We saw when the proposal to fund a plan was on the ballot a few years back that the region really was split. It lost by less than 1%. So in your mind, what needs to happen for a form of regional transit to be supported, or what do you think that the region realistically would like to see in terms of regional transit?
I think the region isn't a monolith. I think what we've got to do is we got to get something done, right? So the Q line was something. The People Mover was something. And the problem with both of those is neither of them are big enough, or do they connect large enough to be practical for most people, right? So you talk about, hey, what would be the next thing that I would do? I would say I would do commuter line between Ann Arbor and Detroit and make that the basis for a regional system that built a robust bus system that allowed us to travel between Detroit and Ann Arbor and all of the Western Wayne and Washtenaw communities, because it won with flying colors in Wayne County and in Washtenaw County and in Detroit. So let's do it where people want to do it. And
sorry, just to clarify, a commuter rail line or a commuter bus line?
Commuter rail, right? So commuter rail is profitable from Ann Arbor to Detroit. There's enough traffic, because that would also include metro airports. You're talking about being able to take a train from the airport downtown, a train to Ann Arbor, a train to Plymouth or Canton or Northville or any one of those communities that have the level of traffic that would make sense, and building the regional transit system around that. Because as much as I hate to say it, if we can't get Oakland County and Macomb County on board right now, that can't allow us not to provide folks with employment opportunities here, because thousands of people go work at Metro Airport. And I think that transportation planning and transportation programming like this are also a way that we make auto insurance more affordable, because people then have options. So we know that there are less people who are riding without or driving without auto insurance. So that should also decrease some of our rates. So this is one of those things that it is hey, if we can get one or two of these things, if we can get a little bit closer to better, that's what we need to be doing, right? So my slogan was, we can do better with Adam because I'm all about better, right? What would the perfect scenario? The perfect scenario is we have light rail going up Woodward, up Gratiot, along Michigan Avenue, and that it's running every 10 to 15 minutes, and then we have a robust bus system going and filling and feeding those things, and you don't need a car. The reality is that's maybe not the case today. You know, it might not ever be the case. So maybe what we should be talking about doing is with Ford Motor Company and their new mobility system right there on Michigan Avenue is, hey, what would a hybrid system look like with autonomous vehicles, with buses, with trains, with this multimodal connecting piece where you can get on your bike and, you know, you have a cold day and you take the train and you throw your bike on there. And then from there, you take your bike and go another 5 or 10 blocks, or you connect that with MoGo. So you have the train or the bus stop and then, oh, shoot, you just hop on the MoGo and you go to the next thing. And so it's really all about integrating the different modes of transportation so that people can get to and from work, so that kids can get to and from school, so that people have control of their ability to move. And I'll never forget how important that is. When I was in Biloxi, I was there after Katrina, and when I got there, people were like, oh, can you believe these people? They all have new cars. They just had this storm, and they were just washed out, and they're not even back in their homes. They're living in these trailers, but they all have new cars. And I said, well, did you think about why they have new cars? And they said, it's because they're irresponsible. It's because they didn't make good decisions. I was like, it's because they were stuck here. It's because they didn't have cars before. It's because the thing that was most important for them after a storm was to be able to get out. And when you start to understand people's perspectives on these things, you start to understand how important it is to get this done. And that's why auto insurance is critical. That's why regional transit is critical, because they are all part of the same thing. And that's people being able to control moving about the world.
So let's talk education. What would you do as a state senator to improve education for the children of your constituents?
So I think in that regard, state senators and politicians in general spend too much time trying to tell educators how to educate. That's not what I want to do. I have a master's in urban planning. I understand systems. I understand space. What I want to do is I want to clear out all the impediments that teachers have for teaching, right? So teachers shouldn't have to be social workers. Teachers shouldn't have to be trying to control whether or not you aid or are going to be on time to school. So the first thing I think we need to do is address all the other crap that gets in the way from kids learning, right? So we talked about the young lady who didn't go to school on time until the sun came up. Let's make it safe, right? And if she can walk to school, she can control being on time to school. The city of Detroit, everyone has is community eligible for free lunch and breakfast, right? But that's not helpful for you if you're late to school because you're waiting on the bus. And so we know that hungry kids don't learn. Oh, hey, magic. If you could walk to school and you got 30 minutes of the 60 minutes you need of physical activity, maybe you will be a better learner because, one, you moved around today, and two, you were able to eat breakfast, you got lunch. So those are types of reforms that I think we need to start with. I want to make sure that we provide every child with an opportunity to be successful. So increasing the programmatic offerings, right? So getting skilled trades and building trades and computer programming and all those things that are not necessarily requiring a four-year education into school early, because those are great jobs. Those are great opportunities. Those are real careers. Those were the original training programs. And I think we've got to get back to understanding what that means. But I'm really passionate about physical education, getting physical education back in schools, getting nutrition back in schools, and then really supporting teachers so that they have what they need to educate their children. But the fundamental issue with education is that it is mostly a socioeconomic status issue, right? So children of parents who went to college are most likely to go to college. And that is because of a variety of things, right? So my daughter is in daycare. She's 9 months old, almost 10 months old. Wow, she's grown so fast. But so she's in daycare. Daycare, on average in the state, on the median cost of daycare in Michigan is about $10,000. We spend a little less than $10,000 to educate children. How insane is it that we spend more to educate, or we spend more to house children in daycare than we do to actually educate them? That's a huge problem that we've got to address. But even more than that, the deficits start from the moment children come home, right? So we're talking about any number of studies that say that in Black families, you know, like mine, or Black households like the one I grew up in, that there was a word deficit between young children. And those things play huge impacts as children continue to grow and progress on how soon they start to speak, on their progression. is those early levels of, hey, are they being taught things from the moment they are come up, or are they being housed? So it's really starting to try and address those things and not say that schools are the problem. It's saying that schools cannot be the solution to everything else. But how do we solve all these other issues and let schools just educate kids?
So why should people vote for you?
Man, that's a tough question. Why should people vote for me? No. people should vote for me because, one, I'm experienced, but two, I care. Like, I love this district. This is where I have spent my entire life. I'm 100% committed to it being better, safer, and just better than it is. And I think when you look at my work experience, when you look at my life experience, I've spent not only my entire life and career becoming qualified and prepared to do this job, but doing the work, you know, working on regional transit, working on the Aerotropolis legislation. When I worked in the mayor's office, one of the big projects that I worked on was the Public Lighting Authority. So with the current director of Public Lighting Authority, we really both spearheaded, you know, that work. So we did the negotiations. And the reason it's so crazy for me is they often say that success has a million followers and failures have none. But when it happened, people were like, oh, no, you're going to cut off all these lights in the city of Detroit. And it was this really controversial issue. And now every single person who could get, you know, can get as close to that lighting thing wants to do it now. But it's about having vision. It's about saying, hey, the things that may be tough, the things that may not be politically correct today, whether it was Hans Farms or Hans Woodlands or the Lighting Authority or the Detroit Works projects, all of which I was involved in very early, that I'm going to be there and I'm going to make the right decisions because I believe in them, because I believe in this community, and because I understand how important it is for the district to get better, for the state to get better. And that means that we take risks. It means that we work much harder than we ever have. Not what you'd expect from me.
Great. Anything else that you would like to say before we conclude our interview?
Yeah, you can reach me. You can go to my website at adamollier.com. That's ADAMHOLLIER.com. So once again, Adam, first name in the Bible, last name looks like Holier, sounds like Ollier. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to serving the residents of the 2nd Senate District. You'll have to vote for me twice. There's a full term and a partial. I'm running unopposed in the partial. And it's an exciting time.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.